Seneca 23, I am no sapiens. Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. The year AD 58 had seen Seneca come under a vicious verbal assault from the venal old advocate Publius Suilius Rufus. Suilius had his nose out of joint because, as the available evidence suggests, Seneca had headed up a senatorial committee which put a stop to Suilius lining his own pocket with his questionable legal practices. Practices with which he'd managed to get away with impunity under the previous Emperor Claudius. In fact, Suilius had a long history of venality in legal circles. He'd actually been convicted of taking bribes as far back as AD 24, but what must have really got up his nose this time around was that it was Seneca, a novus homo, a man not born into the patrician class to which Suilius belonged, who was responsible for the old crook's downfall and exile to the Balearic Islands. But as we heard in the last podcast, Suilius didn't go down without a fight. He had a massive go back at Seneca, using whatever ammunition he could find lying around, and there was plenty of it. Suilius played to the gallery, reminding them that Seneca had been exiled to Corsica back in AD 41-42 for shagging Julia Lavilla, and he followed that up with a fresh accusation that Seneca was now doing the same to Julia's sister Agrippina. Suilius also attempted to emasculate Seneca by impugning his virtus, his essential manliness, something integral to the Roman male's perception of himself. He compared Seneca's total lack of military experience to Suilius's own very active record when on campaign with the late great Germanicus, a comparison designed to further highlight Seneca's alleged shameful behaviour, because Germanicus had been the father of Julia Lavilla and Agrippina, the princesses with whom Seneca had, according to Suilius, been sexually involved. And to add insult to injury, Suilius must have known that his barbs against Seneca's virtus and lack of military pedigree would have hit home hard in a year when General Corbulo was doing such great and manly deeds, heading up the Roman machine in Armenia. And there was also, of course, the glaringly obvious target of Seneca's hypocrisy. How dare this man, how dare this upstart, outspoken and oft-published advocate for Stoic moderation and living according to the dictates of nature, show his face in public when it was open knowledge that he sat on a vast fortune through lavish banquets and held property all over the Roman world. All in all, it was quite the character assassination. Now, Suilius himself was too steeped in bribery and corruption, had far too long a track record of dodgy courtroom shenanigans to be able to get off the hook of the allegations levelled against him. But it was obvious that he was trying to take Seneca down with him, and, in my opinion, was attempting to do so as the mouthpiece of what must have been an anti-Seneca senatorial faction, a faction that was, as yet, too wary to come out openly against Seneca themselves. Their problem was that, despite all indication that Seneca had, by AD 58, pretty much lost control over Nero's worsening behaviour, he nevertheless remained the amicus principis, the emperor's closest official advisor. Which meant that, if you belonged to a party interested in taking the so-called upstart Seneca down, you had to be very, very careful about how you went about achieving it. Therefore, it seems to me that making the accused Suilius their cat's paw to sway opinion against the emperor's closest advisor, while they themselves stayed in the background, was, under the circumstances, a pretty sensible strategy. Now, history tells us that Suaelius was convicted and exiled, but it still left Seneca with a huge mop-up operation on his hands. He'd pretty much been caught bang to rights by the character assassination levelled against him. Oh, sure, he could perhaps shrug off the insinuation that he was sleeping with Agrippina. He and she had, after all, fallen out some time before. And he could point to his well-known long-term bronchial issues as a reason for never having made a military name for himself. But the accusations of hypocrisy, now they were the ones that could stick. For years, decades actually, Seneca had been pumping out treatise after treatise about how to live a life that aspired to philosophical sainthood. He gave advice on how to become a sapiens, that state at which the master Stoic achieves a fortress-like mind, operating on pure reason alone. A state in which all those different elements that make up life's lottery, illness, good health, poverty, riches and so forth, were regarded as indifferentia or indifference, things that were neither good nor bad in and of themselves, but tools to be used for self-betterment. And although he'd never come right out and explicitly stated as such, it was easy enough to read into Seneca's prose that he considered himself, if only by implication, well on the road to that sapienship. The problem was, of course, that despite all the high-minded prose pouring from Seneca's stylus, all of this money doesn't matter to me, it is ultimately inconsequential, and I aspire to a life of moderation in all things type of thing, all the Roman citizenship, at least the anti-Seneca contingent of it, could see, was an extremely rich crony of the emperor, splashing out cash left, right and centre on expensive furniture, lavish banquets and an ever-growing property portfolio on which he purportedly charged very high rents and interest. In short, to the Romans of the late AD 50s, what Seneca was preaching seemed to be the polar opposite of what Seneca was in reality practicing. Now, there's no doubt whatsoever, in my mind anyway, that Seneca was fully aware that the seeming gulf between his words and deeds was a massive problem, and one which, if he left it unaddressed, would leave him vulnerable to future character assassinations, any of which might prove more damaging than the Suaelius episode. So he had to act, and he knew just how to do it. And if you followed our podcast series this far, it'll come as no surprise that Seneca once again went for the most powerful weapon in his personal arsenal, his stylus. And this time, what he wrote was a work of extraordinary genius. De Vita Beata, or On the Happy Life, is brilliant. Of Seneca's entire corpus, it's my personal favourite. It's Seneca at his sublime best, a superb writer pulling out all the rhetorical stops as he dances on the edge of the abyss of political and personal extinction. The vocabulary he uses is that of a man writing for his life. You see, in order to head off at the pass any future accusations of hypocrisy against his character, what Seneca had to do in De Vita Beata was somehow convince his readership and the Roman world in general that although yes he had great wealth and that although yes he was a very flawed individual, nevertheless, and this is the really important bit, he was actively trying to become a better person, and that the effort he was making to become a better person actively entitled him to write about the process. And while he was trying to achieve all of that, he had to also somehow discredit his accusers in such a final way that they could never again use the same ammunition that Suaelius had used to discredit him. And Seneca pulls the whole thing off brilliantly, because in a quite breathtaking combination of barefaced cheek and readership manipulation, he somehow manages to convince his audience that not only is it quite okay to dish out advice on how to live a life of virtue when he himself is sunk in a pit of vice, but also that his accusers are themselves shameless and base creatures for levelling the accusations in the first place. It's quite extraordinary. So let's see how he managed to pull it off. We'll start with the chronology, because as with most of Seneca's works, the timing of De Vita Beata is disputed, but it was obviously written at a time when Seneca's political star was in the descendant. In fairness, it could have been composed anywhere between the years AD 58 to 63, but given the content, which I'll come to shortly, my money is on the period after the Suaelius attack in AD 58, so either that year or shortly afterwards. Like all Seneca's works, De Vita Beata functions on multiple levels. In it, he is responding to what must have been very public accusations of hypocrisy. That is, why was he dishing out advice in his books about the benefits of abstention and moderation when he was obviously up to his neck in the outrageous shenanigans at Nero's court? Now, Seneca understood that he was a very easy target for an attempt at character assassination, but he knew also that he was an extremely adept, sublimely skillful wordsmith. The way in De Vita Beata in which Seneca turns accusations made against him into a political counterattack is truly masterful. The construction of the book is quite brilliant. It comprises two very different halves. The first half, sections 1 to 16, reads like a fairly standard treatise on how to achieve a state of philosophical contentment, De Vita Beata, the happy life. And then, from section 17 onwards, literally from one line to the next, there's a jarring change of tone and a transition into what can only be described as a self-justificatory rant against Seneca's detractors. The second half of the book, section 17, opens with an address to his enemies, Istis qui philosophiam con latrant, those who bark together against philosophy. Their depiction as dogs whose yapping is both annoying and incomprehensible is quite deliberate. Seneca then goes on to list what sounds very much like many of the accusations of hypocrisy levelled against him in the Senate by Suaelius, before coming out with the totally unexpected, show-stopping, open admission, non sum sapiens, et ut malevolentiam tuam pascam nec ero. I am not a sapiens, a wise man, and just to feed your malevolence, I will never be one. Now talk about deliberately taking the wind out of his would-be detractor's sails. And I'll bet any money Seneca's enemies weren't expecting that admission. Seneca, of course, doesn't leave it there. He goes on to tell his detractors never to expect the best out of him, because he personally will never achieve it. But, and this is the big but, at least he is trying to improve himself, even if that effort may not achieve much. It is enough for me, he says, to daily subtract at least some element from among my number of vices and scold myself for the mistakes I make. I may have gout, Seneca spits at his opponents in a comparison of his efforts at self-betterment to theirs, but when I compare your feet to mine, crippled though I am a sprinter. And then Seneca explains in a nutshell why there is absolutely nothing at all hypocritical about what he writes. Haec non pro me loquor, ego enim in alto vitiorum omnium sum, sed pro illo cui aliquid acti est. I don't say these things on my own behalf, because I myself am steeped in vice of every kind, but on behalf of the man by whom something has actually been achieved. In other words, Seneca is making it crystal clear to the entire Roman world that the perfect individual, the sapiens, he writes about in his philosophical treatises, is not himself. He personally is far too flawed for that. But the person he believes that every Roman, indeed every human being, should ultimately aspire to become. The jarring tone shift between the two halves of De Vita Beata has led many commentators to suggest that they belong to two different works, but I think those commentators are missing the point. Because in my opinion, the abrupt tone and content shift is totally deliberate and a devastatingly effective rhetorical trick. My take on it is that the two so-called halves of De Vita Beata, although stylistically distinct, actually work in perfect concert. See, to understand what Seneca was pulling off here, we have to understand that he's under political and personal attack. The disparity between how his works advise his readership to live their lives and the opulence and extravagance of his own lifestyle is plain for the whole Roman people to see. Up until this point in his career, Seneca's almost politically bulletproof position as Nero's closest advisor has protected him from allegations of gross hypocrisy. But times are changing. Seneca's star is falling, and his political enemies scent an opening. His glaring double standards are an easy target, and Suilius had been used as a foghorn to openly voice what many are thinking. So Seneca has to think on his feet, and his response to the attempt at character assassination by making the two halves of his book work together is absolutely masterful. By filling the first half with advice on how to achieve a balanced, happy existence through the exercise of virtue, and the second half fully admitting that he is sunk in vice, Seneca is actually proving on parchment that you do not have to be a practitioner of the happy life in order to be able to give others advice on it. Now think about that. In a modern analogy, it would be rather like a chain smoker dishing out advice and writing on the benefits of giving up smoking. Now, just because somebody is a habitual smoker, it doesn't stop them admiring the restraint and improved health of the reformed smoker and wishing to be one themselves, and nor does it prevent them from acquiring deep expertise on how to quit smoking and encouraging others to do so. And that, in De Vita Beata, is exactly what Seneca is pulling off. I am a complete shitbucket, he is saying. But that doesn't mean I don't want to become a better person. I really am trying, as much as I can, under these circumstances, to become a better person. And I just so happen to have read up a lot on how to become a better person. And that is what I am sharing with you in my writings. And if some of you want to think that makes me a hypocrite, then that makes you petty, small-minded morons. As the second half of De Vita Beata progresses, so Seneca's invective against his detractors, those people who are unable to distinguish between the efforts of those who strive to better themselves and the ultimate goal of philosophy itself, deepens. The prose is a real roller coaster of Seneca pulling out all the stops and employing every rhetorical trick in his arsenal. And I just have to share with you the following passage of pure disdain for the lowlives who, Seneca says, were daring to criticise his motives. But as for you lot, he spits out, it comes as absolutely no surprise that you hate virtue and those who worship her. Because sickly lights dread the sun, and creatures of the night shun the shining day, struck dumb at the breaking of dawn as they scatter to their lairs and conceal themselves in cracks in the ground, terrified of the light. Why don't you croak and waggle your wretched tongues in mockery of the light? Go on, bare your fangs, bite hard. You'll break your teeth long before you leave a mark. I love that passage. It's a brilliant put down. It's a real case of, come and have a go at me if you think you're hard enough. On and on Seneca goes, defending his good fortune, explaining that it's not wealth itself that matters, but what you do with it. He explains the whole philosophical system of indifferentia that I mentioned in passing earlier, something that the Greek philosophers called adiaphora, that sliding scale of things like health and ill health, wealth and poverty, things that are neither good nor bad in and of themselves, which can be used as vehicles or tools with which to achieve the ultimate good. And having explained what these indifferent things are, Seneca poses a question to his audience. Given the choice, he asks, between wealth and poverty, health and ill health, if those opposites were offered as tools for self-betterment, which would you rather have? The implication is, of course, that we would all choose wealth and health. So why then blame Seneca for making that self-same choice? Like the shift in tone between the two halves of the book, the ending of De Vita Beata is also rather abrupt, again something that's led many commentators to believe that the work structure, as it's come down to us, is corrupted. This time they feel that the book is truncated and that Seneca actually wrote more than is transmitted down to the modern reader. But again, I feel that those commentators are missing the point here, because for me, the ending of De Vita Beata perfectly fits the book's structure and purpose. Why? Because I believe that what the closing lines hold is nothing short of a veiled and hanging threat made against any individual or faction still thinking of taking Seneca down. But I, he writes in the final section of De Vita Beata, looking down from a high place, I see the storms that are either looming above you, about to burst over your head with their flood, or ones that are already near and closing in, ready to sweep away both you and yours. Why bother going on? Even though you're hardly aware of it, doesn't a type of whirlwind ready twist and spin your minds as they're torn apart, trying to flee from and seek out the same things at the same time? Minds that are lifted up on high one moment and dashed into the deeps the next. And it's right there at that very point that the book ends. In my mind, the message is crystal clear. Don't mess with me, it says. You've been warned. Now, you could argue that in that closing passage, Seneca was coming from a purely philosophical viewpoint. That is because his reading told him that the goddess Fortuna, in other words, life's lottery, is capable of wreaking indiscriminate havoc on all our lives. He was aware that she could mess with the lives of his enemies at any time. And on one level, that may well have been his intention. But Seneca was more than capable of working on many levels, because I think he was also reminding his enemies, hey you lot, I'm still up here. Whether you like it or not, I'm still the amicus principis, and I hold high and exalted political office. And should I choose to do so, I can mess with your lives any time I feel like it. To end a work by leaving a threat hanging over those who were trying to bring him down in a book that was supposedly an instruction manual on how to achieve the happy life would have been such a deliciously ironic Senecan thing to do, and I feel one that would have amused him no end. So did it work? Did De Vita Beata get Seneca off the hook as far as allegations of hypocrisy were concerned? Well, yes, it worked perfectly, because the charge doesn't seem to have been levied against him again, at least for the remainder of his own lifetime. But if the main motive behind composing the work was one of political survival, there was also a very deliberate byproduct. Seneca's justification for the gaping discrepancies between what he wrote and what he was actually doing also allowed him to plot a succinct and vivid path on how to achieve contentment in life. De vita beata was obviously, therefore, for Seneca, also an opportunity to instruct his fellow man on how to become happy with his lot in the universe by using Seneca's own unique status, that's one straddling the line between counsellor to the emperor of a depraved court and a dispenser of life coaching advice, as a yardstick. So it's hard not to feel that there's also a big element of introspection and self-motivation in De Vita Beata, because although he'd managed to head his enemies off at the pass this time, things were beginning to fall apart at the seams for Seneca in general. De Vita Beata, then, is not some pie-in-the-sky philosophical fancy, but the real words of a very flawed man who describes in eminently practical terms what needs to be done, the headspace you need to zone into to achieve a degree of mental and emotional resilience in life. And Seneca was going to need it, because things were about to get really bad. In the next podcast, we'll look at the events of the watershed year AD 59, when it must have become obvious even to Seneca that Nero was now totally and utterly out of control. And I hope to see you there.